This is the Future of HR Podcast, episode 173. Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining the Future of HR Podcast for a special episode for a special time of year. I'm releasing this on December 30th, right in the middle of the holiday season, a time when many of us are with our family, our loved ones, and those special somebodies who make our lives worth living. And I'm starting here today because this episode isn't your typical Future of HR conversation. It's not really about the future of HR at all. It's about honoring the people in our lives who've shaped us and helped us to become who we are today. In a few minutes, I'll be joined by Ian Ziskin, Lori Helfinger, and Bill Baker to talk about Ian's new book, Lives Lost and Leadership Found, Lessons from Special Somebodies. And inside this book, 35 HR leaders share their stories about people they've lost and ask a profound question. How can loss teach us about leadership and life? Before I get into their incredible stories in this incredible book, I want to share my story. My special somebody, my father. My dad tragically passed away before I was 30 years old. He had had surgery to remove colon cancer, and within 4 days, he was gone. It was unexpected as he was healthy. This truly hit my family hard, and honestly, I think about him almost every day. And I know my mom does as well. My dad was in the gumball machine business. And before you smile, yes, that gumball machine business. But it wasn't just how he made money, it was his passion. He didn't buy stock gum machines from a vending machine company. He actually built custom wooden gumball machines, one-of-a-kind pieces that were truly beautiful, truly works of art. And while gumball machines never became my passion, they taught me almost as much as my dad did. I'll never forget the day I thought I was getting into the family business. I was 15 and a half, getting close to my driver's license. But there was a catch. No job meant no car. And like every teenager, I had my eye on a truck, and I was willing to do almost anything to get it. And one Saturday morning after breakfast, my parents made me an offer. Instead of getting a typical hourly job, they'd give me 8 gumball machines. My dad would teach me how to locate and operate my own route. The upside, once I got the machines placed, I could make money without punching a clock. The downside, I had to learn to sell. I had to walk into businesses and convince small business owners to let me put a gumball machine in their store for a small cut of the revenue. After some thought and reflection, I told my parents I was in as long as my dad taught me how to be a real salesperson. And over the next few weekends, we went out early in the morning and didn't come back till late night. It took over a month to find homes for all 8 of those machines. And at first, it wasn't easy. But every time we went out, I learned a little more about business and a little bit more about life from my dad. As we were driving around looking for a home for my 8th and final machine, I asked my dad, "How am I ever going to make enough money to buy that truck?" He smiled at me and said, "JP, don't worry, you'll make the money." I said, "But how?" He smiled even wider, looked me square in the eyes and said, "JP, you'll earn the money for the truck like everyone else in this family, one gumball at a time." For my dad, one gumball at a time wasn't just a motivational quote for an impatient teenager. It was how he lived his life, both professionally and personally. He was rarely in a bad mood, and he woke up believing today and every day was going to be better than yesterday, and he was usually right. I did get that truck, and I built a small but profitable gumball machine business. I went to college, and then I went to grad school. And then at 23, I almost quit my PhD program in organizational psychology. I was just drowning in my second semester. The coursework, it felt pointless. The research seemed disconnected from anything real. I just couldn't see how a lot of this was going to help me make a difference or build a career or make any money in the future. So I called my dad and I said, "Dad, I think I should quit. Maybe I get an MBA, or hell, maybe I should just start a gumball machine business with you." And I think I rambled for 15 minutes about how hard it was, how I was wasting my time, and my dad just stopped me cold. So, "JP, do you remember what I used to tell you when you were placing gumball machines when you were 16 and impatient to get that truck?" I knew where this was going, but I didn't say anything. And he said one gumball at a time. But he didn't stop there. He said nothing worth doing is easy. There are no shortcuts to your PhD, just like there are no shortcuts to that truck. And no one can take that PhD away from you, but only you can decide if it's worth earning. That conversation became a turning point. I didn't just stay in grad school. I recommitted, I thrived, and I got my PhD. Unfortunately, my dad passed away shortly after that, but he lives on in everything I do. And when I started this podcast, I committed to one episode a week for a year to see what would happen. One episode at a time. One guest at a time. And now we're over 170 episodes and over 300,000 downloads, which is amazing. Building a business to develop next-gen HR leaders and elevate our function, I think about this one client at a time, one next-gen leader at a time, one day at a time. If I've learned anything over the past 20 years, it's this. The path to big results is paved with ordinary actions repeated consistently. Doing what's right, doing it well, and doing it day in and day out. You don't need a perfect strategy. You don't need a perfect plan. You just have to take the next step. One gumball at a time. I'm so grateful for my dad, and thank you so much for listening to this tribute to him. It means a lot. I also want to encourage you to go out and buy this book, Lives Lost and Leadership Found, Lessons from Special Somebodies. It's available everywhere books are sold, and it's a great book. It's a great tribute. I think you'll learn a lot and enjoy it, and it might even inspire you to write about your special someone. And with that, let's get into my conversation with Ian, Lori, and Bill, and hear about their special someones and the leadership lessons they've learned from them. Happy holidays, and thanks for listening to Future of HR. Ian, Lori, and Bill, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. This is a different episode because we're really going to dive into a book that I know that meant a lot to each of you and to every author who contributed to Lives Lost and Leadership Found. So while you are all HR leaders, and I think almost everyone, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, were HR leaders in the book in general, maybe not all of them. The 35 authors, were they mostly HR leaders?
I would say mostly, JP, but not all. Other people, CEOs of their own businesses, senior leaders and the like.
Yeah, and I think it's great. So it's an amazing book. There's a lot to be learned there. So this episode will not be, we're not going to dive into some of the tactics and some of the things about being an HR leader, but I think there's a real connection to human spirit and work and the impact we have on people's lives. So I think you made an amazing connection there. And so I want people to go out and read the book. But Ian, we've known each other for a while. And one thing that has just set you apart, you say this in the book, but when I read it, I was like, oh, I get it now because you've lived this, is the spirit of abundance mindset and this Friends for Life philosophy. Tell us about what this means to you and how it's influenced how you've approached relationships, your career, and just life in general.
The book reflects that personal philosophy in the sense that while I'm the lead author, it's really a collective, collaborative effort from a lot of people, including contributing authors, two of whom we have with us today, in Bill and Lori. For me, the spirit of abundance has always meant we can do better together, collaborating with one another on whatever the pursuit may be, than trying to compete with and undermine one another. So for me, it's about raising the bar for everyone, including the contributions to this book. Similarly, the Friends for Life philosophy, I just happen to be one of those people that loves to convene and bring people together. And no matter what walk of life I might happen to meet you, once we've met and connected, I consider you a friend for life and encourage people to reach out if I can be helpful in some way, because I certainly won't be shy and have not historically been shy in reaching out to other people, asking for their help as well. It's just a philosophy that's actually worked very well for me, both personally and professionally.
I love that. I think it's really important, especially for HR leaders early in their career, to have that philosophy of abundance versus competition, to really give value before you try to get value. That goes a long ways in people's career. But I'm curious for Lori and Bill, do you guys have a personal philosophy or mindset that's guided you over your career and life? And Lori, I'll start with you.
I appreciate the time to think about it. I have 3 points. The first one is resilience. Second one is relationships. And the third is lifelong learning. So really about resilience, I think survival and ultimately thriving can happen in challenging times. Deaths, job loss, global pandemic, global financial crisis. And it can be both simultaneously scary and exhilarating. And then with relationships, I think it's important to build relationships with friends, family, and colleagues, to work, to be willing to debate, and then be willing to let go of people who aren't working. And then finally, lifelong learning, never give up. Hang out with people who are different from you, older than you, younger than you, and smarter than you.
Almost everyone I talk to, I think, is one of those three categories for sure. So appreciate it. I love that, Lori. Bill, how about you?
One is tied to my grandmother, whom I wrote about in the book. And the other one is just learning over time. As your career advances and your life gets busier and you run out of time to be able to do everything that you want to do, you have to find some way to decide what's most important and what stays on the list and what goes off the list, right? For me, that's really been making sure I remember the why for what I'm doing. If that starts to get out of focus, just start really asking myself questions about, well, then why are you doing it? And that can be in my professional life. That can be in my personal life. I think professionally, like you get involved and like, we're going to redesign some program. It's very easy to get caught up in the logistics of that and then lose sight of the outcome, or to get tired of working on something that's tedious or whatever. But then you remember, wait, this is actually going to make people's lives better. That's the reason to do it. And I can get reinvigorated about that. If I lose my tether to what the broader meaning of it is, that's a trigger for me. I really need to start thinking about, do I need to continue to do this? Does this need to come off the list rather than be on the list? The other that kind of popped into my head is something my grandmother used to talk about a lot. Your ears need more exercise than your mouth, and you need to spend more time listening than talking. Some version of that, she was nicer about it than I just said it, but really thinking through, like, how much space do you want to take up? And when you are talking, is it additive or is it just noise? So I try to really be conscious of listen more than I talk and try to be helpful, additive, teach somebody something, make it a valuable contribution before I start talking.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Lori. Obviously, some parallels there and some different paths. And you can see the connection to the book a little bit. And Ian, you've written 5 books, but this one is definitely a little different. And tell us a little more about what compelled you to bring together 35 different voices to write Lives Lost and Leadership Found.
For me, it really started with my own loss. I imagine we'll talk a little bit more in detail about this as we get into the conversation. But both my brother and my mother passed away in 2023, about 6 months apart. You know, in addition to the typical getting rocked back and grieving process that most people typically go through in that type of situation, it really got me thinking about, what did I learn from them about life, first of all? And then secondly, were there any implications for leadership and me as a leader, especially somebody who spent a lot of my career in the leadership space? Then from there, pretty quickly, I started thinking about, well, I'm not really the only person on the planet who's ever lost somebody important to me. So I wonder what other people might be thinking about this and whether they've thought of somebody who is special to them, who they might have learned something from about life and leadership, and began to reach out to a number of friends and colleagues in my network, including Lori and Bill, along with many others. And lo and behold, discovered there was a lot of interest and energy in sharing those stories. And that's, in fact, how the book came together.
Yeah, it's a great story. And it's, again, kind of goes back to your idea of abundance and friends for life and people sharing. And I think there is something about that kind of combined human spirit and coming together and saying, hey, I have someone who's really special. And I don't get to tell the story very often or very many places. And so that's why I think the book is really cool and special. I wonder, Ian, maybe talk a little bit more about the title for your chapter, which was Friends for Life, and who your special somebody was. And tell us more about that story.
Yeah. So going back to what I mentioned a minute ago, my brother, who was 60 at the time, ended up getting diagnosed with metastatic cancer, They thought actually at first maybe he was having a stroke, but then pretty quickly discovered brain tumors as well as tumors throughout his body. From the time of entering the hospital and diagnosis to his death was about 8 days. Very fast process. In some ways, very fortunately, in the sense that he didn't suffer for very long, but totally unexpected in a variety of different ways. About 6 months later, my mother, who was 93, so you probably could not argue that passing away was unexpected of somebody of that age. I like the expression that kind of describes it, which is she was fine until she wasn't. One of these circumstances where she started experiencing stomach pains, went to the hospital, and about 5 hours later, passed away from cardiac arrest. Her body basically just shut down from all the stress that she was experiencing. So in both of these cases, not really expecting to have it occur, but also a recognition on my part. These are both very important people in my life, had huge influence on me as a human being, as well as a professional and as a leader. And so really started processing some of the things that I learned from them, a couple of which I'll just mention now for purposes of conversation. So one in particular that really stuck with me was the idea of facing reality and dealing with it. Most human beings have this enormous capacity to deny, deflect, dismiss, explain away facts or data or circumstances that don't reinforce their preferred view. I learned from watching them in action, both things that they did and things that they probably should have done but didn't, the importance of dealing with a reality. I think another one was advocacy, particularly a lesson learned from my mother, the willingness to stand up for and fight for yourself and others, the things that you believe in terms of what's right in the world and what's not right in the world, and how do you advocate for what you believe and maybe against things that you don't believe are correct. Those were really some lessons that stuck very deeply with me.
Sorry to hear about their loss, of course, on both counts. It's just interesting to know how much everyone really has an impact on us, right? Just even sometimes those small moments, to your point of you may not have known they were standing up for courage, or really talking about defining reality. You look back and say, that's what I really learned from them. And I think it's really impactful. And Lori, your chapter was titled Resilience Without Regret. Can you share more about who your special someone was and how they impacted you?
Yes, I'll tell a little bit about my mother. She was born in 1933 during the Great Depression on a small farm in Nebraska. Her father died when she was 2. She was the youngest of 6. Her mother then raised 6 kids on welfare and midwifery. So you start to see the resilience theme. She went to college, met my father at a YWCA or YMCA dance. I think it was love at first sight. They were engaged in 3 months and danced for 8 years, I would say. It was a great marriage that yielded 2 kids, myself and my younger brother. But my dad died too soon. He died of a heart attack. My mother was 33 and, of course, took the death very hard. As you would expect, I was 7. My brother was 5. But she got herself together. She went back to college. She got her master's degree. She taught. And then she took my brother and I all over the country to meet her siblings. She created kind of an extended support network for us. My dad died and left her without a will, and he was in business. While he had a full-time job, he was in business with the neighbor with these low-income rental properties. He was in business with my uncle, who was a pretty tough dude, off wheat farms. And because he didn't have a will, she had to split the assets 3 ways with my brother and I. So she's managing, going back, getting her master's, 2 kids, the loss of her soulmate, now having to deal with these businesses that she never would have been in before. So she dealt with it all. She got all through it. And then ultimately, she married. It didn't work out. She got out of it quickly, remarried again. And that was my stepfather. He was amazing. They were together till death. But it was a blended family. Wasn't the Brady Bunch, but it did work. It did work. I'm still close to my stepsister and brother to this day. But she demonstrated resilience and relationships. And when she died, left a legacy of stepkids, grandkids. I stay connected with my stepsister because I feel like if I don't, it would be like my parents got divorced. And the other thing is she was a leader in her own right, a subtle leader, but definitely a leader. I learned resilience, relationships, which are two of my values, but also having fun. In spite of all that, she had a lot of fun.
She sounds like an incredible woman, and there's a lot of resilience there, right? When you think about over your lifetime, the hardships that maybe your parents had, right? And like how good we have it today, and things we complain about today, and actually how difficult it might have been to the situation. She was widowed at 33, having to go back to school. It is amazing sometimes when you look back and you can appreciate that. I only hope my kids, and probably same thing for your children, maybe they appreciate what we do for them and say, hey, you know, our mom and dad tried really hard. So that's a great story. Thank you for sharing that, Lori. Bill, your chapter was titled The Imprints We Leave. Share more about your special someone and what you want us to know about them.
You know, it's funny listening to Lori. It makes me think, I wonder how many common themes about our special someones that cut across, because some of what you were saying, Lori, I could apply to my grandmother. I mentioned earlier that's who I wrote about. It's, we're all human, and I kind of wonder if it's some of the same common appeals that makes us remember, and these people had such an impact on us. There are lots of things I could say about my grandmother, but she certainly was resilient. She was a leader, though she would be mortified. One, she'd be mortified by the fact she's getting all this attention to start with, let alone that I would be calling her a leader. She'd be like, I do okay. Don't stop talking about me. Be more like her reaction. She was born in the early 1900s, grew up in a small southern town, big family. They worked farm. She got married. She had a baby. He died very young. Several years later, they tried again and they had three more kids. And then my grandfather died. She built her life around managing the home. And then she realized, wait a minute, I need to manage the things that I have never really had to manage before now, because he's not here. She set about doing that. My grandfather had talked to one of his sisters about, you got to look out for Murdy, was my grandmother's name. You got to look out for Murdy. And she was not having that. She's like, I will find my way to take care of myself and find my way in the world, even though I've had this loss in my life. The thing that has always stuck with me on some level, but until I wrote the book, and like when Ian sent out the note and said, hey, would anybody be interested in doing this? My first reaction was like, no way. And then I thought about it for like 20 seconds. And I'm like, wait, maybe if I'm ever going to write anything, maybe this is the thing to write. It's because things became super clear as I started to think about her. And I was always very close to her. I was very close to my other grandparents as well, but always super close to her. And the thing that stands out in my mind about her is kindness. But that shouldn't be confused with not dealing with things that she needed to deal with. She'd had a lot of hardship in her life. She had to manage a lot of loss and things that happened over the course of a long life. She lived to be in her 90s as well. But even when she was doing tough things, she was always kind. From a leadership point of view, I realize, and particularly in HR, sometimes we have to do tough things. No matter how tough it is, no matter what the situation is, there's never a reason not to be kind. And that I link back to her and watching her my whole childhood. Difficult situations, easy situations, that was something that was always consistent about her. Even when we were dealing with something, her individually or us as a family, that, you know, maybe wasn't so pleasant, I can never recall a time when she was not kind to others. I think as a leader, I try to do that. If that can be my prevailing motivation, no matter how aggravated I might be about something or how angry I might be about or upset about something, if that can be my prevailing motivation, then I can have a positive impact on other people and I can make a positive representation of how you deal with things. I can reach a resolution in the best way possible. I reflect on her imprints on me and realize we all leave imprints on each other to varying degrees, some a lot, some a little. But if you're having an interaction with somebody, even if it's holding the door for them at the Starbucks, you have left an imprint. That's where the name came from. But as I thought about her and all the things I learned from her, that's the way I think about it. That was an imprint. That was an imprint. I tell this story about her baking cakes and talking about grating the coconut. And I asked her, why don't you just use the store-bought grated coconut? And she's like, not for this cake, not in my house. And that's a quality lesson, right? What are your standards? lots of things to translate that I carry with me even now.
Well, I think if we can have a world where people are realizing they're having an imprint on others and that we should be kind to each other, the world would be a better place. So I think there's some great lessons there, Bill. Ian, one of the things that's fascinating about the book is you got into neuroscience research. You got a little geeky about grief and leadership. And what surprised you about some of the science about how loss can rewire us as leaders?
Yeah, I really wanted to have some science-based underpinning as a foundation to what else we might learn, you know, in writing this book. Here's a few things I've learned about the connection between neuroscience, loss, and leadership. First of all, huge impact on brain and body, right? So if you think about things like heart rate, blood pressure, cortisol, stress, memory, brain fog, huge impact. And probably the single biggest thing that really caught my attention is the fact that loved ones, people we care a lot about, are actually imprinted in our brains. When we lose someone really important to us, the brain actually rewires. There's a physical and physiological response, but also an emotional and mental response to the loss. That really got my attention because it also connects quite directly, I found, to our role as leaders. For example, David Rock, Jeffrey Schwartz, they have a lot of expertise in the neuroleadership space. And they talk about this concept, which I thought really applied quite well to the book, which is that change is pain and focus is power. And then most of us who are in HR or leadership roles understand change from the perspective of organizational change. And yes, it's true. Lots of organizational change creates a certain degree of pain. But from a personal standpoint, there's probably no bigger change that we can experience in life than losing somebody who's really important to us. That creates pain and discomfort, but it also literally creates pain, physical pain. The second half of that equation is that if you have the ability to focus, learn from the experience, process the loss, do it in an intentional way, and hopefully we'll get a chance to talk a little bit about that notion of intention, that actually creates power. It gives us power to work our way through the loss, but also power to come out the other side as better, more effective people and leaders.
Yeah, it's really interesting in this idea of the pain or the focus and the idea of being intentional. And you talk about this idea of tensions of intentionality, which is a tongue twister there, but a really interesting chapter I found really interesting. But talk more about some of an impact for us, if you can, Ian, just the tensions that you found around leadership and loss.
To the points that Bill and Lori were just making in some of their comments, it is true that even though every story in the book was different, I mean, there are essays contributed by well over 35 contributing authors, 35 different essays. Every person that's talked about is different. Each story is different, but there are some common themes. Part of that really got my attention, which is first important to know that largely these ordinary people who lived ordinary lives, who died, unfortunately, but in relatively ordinary ways, yet they were extraordinary in terms of their impact and influence on the people around them, including the contributing authors who wrote about them, as Bill alluded to a minute ago. His grandmother probably would not think of herself as a leader, yet she was and had huge leadership impact, just like Lori's mom or my mother and brother. That was a really important element of this, which led to this set of observations I made about the tensions of intentionality, because in almost every story, there was some kind of evidence of turning a negative into a positive or turning lemons into lemonade in terms of going through this difficult, painful experience. But how did you come out the other end with something more positive that you were able to learn and grow as a person or as a leader? So there are seven of these different tensions in the book. I won't talk about each one, but I'll give you a couple of examples for now. First of all, there's a social media influencer that I found really fascinating on this topic. Her name is Giselle Ibarra. She says that life is a paradox. In order to heal, you must hurt. I think we found that throughout the book, these tensions that I referred to are basically these paradoxes or competing priorities that you kind of have to work your way through to come out better on the other side. So first you hurt and you go through some pain and some suffering, and on the other side you heal. A couple of examples that had particular meaning for me, one was the shift from fog to clarity. So most people will tell you, and the brain science will also tell you this, that when you're going through this type of loss, you experience brain fog and you're not thinking as clearly as you normally would. A lot of experts on grief will advise people, don't make any really important life or financial decisions for at least 3 months, maybe 6 months, possibly even a year, because you're not going to be giving the best of yourself to the big decision as you go through the thought process. In my own case, when my brother passed away, I mentioned a while ago, I was living in the New York area where I live, and he and my mother are both living in Atlanta. So I was looking to get on a plane as fast as I could and get there to get to the hospital. But to this day, 2 years later, I still do not remember my drive to the airport, any time that I spent in the airport, being on the airplane, or anything else that happened up to the time that I saw my mother when I arrived at the hospital. Everything else was a complete blank. So you have to allow a certain amount of time and processing to come out the other side, which is more clarity. The second theme, which was very consistent for others who wrote for the book, in addition to my own experience, is this shift from compartmentalization to integration. In other words, some of the people who were really good at processing the loss and learning from it were also extremely good at compartmentalizing. They were able to take their feelings and their grief, put it in a special box off to the side or in the back of their mind, because they also had to function in life, you know, take care of their family, go to work every day, and those other kinds of things that we all have to deal with. But eventually, you run out of airspeed and altitude in trying to compartmentalize, and you have to integrate everything back together. And the faster and more productively you do that, the more you get back up on your feet. So the bottom line of all of this came out for me as follows. There's this old adage that says, time heals all wounds. As a result of writing this book, I don't believe that. I actually believe that intentionality heals all wounds. Time helps, but you also have to be very intentional about what you've learned, what you're feeling, what you're processing, and how am I going to get to the other side so that I end up feeling like I learned something of value from the person that I lost. And fundamentally, I think at the end of the day, that's what this entire book has been all about.
Really great lessons around that piece. I'm wondering, Laurie or Bill, do you have anything you want to add to that experience that you heard from Ian there?
Yes. In working with leaders, the leaders who have experienced the most challenge, be it either in the business, personally, are some of the best leaders. And the leaders who may have faced challenges but haven't dealt with it or integrated it are probably not as good, right? Not as self-aware, not as good at relating to people. When they get to be in their mid-50s and I encounter one of these people, I'm like, oh no, this is going to be a really tough case because they haven't been challenged and overcome. They have had it easy, or they think they've had it easy all their life. And yet you'll see some leaders at the top of the organization who are so amazing. And when you really talk to them one-on-one and you find out what they've been through, you're shocked. How could they be so good and gone through all of that? So I think loss and challenge are the fodder for great leadership, frankly.
That's a great insight, Laurie.
Tensions of intentionality. Intentionality is the word that really stands out to me. When you go through suffering or pain or difficulties, realizing that embracing that to learn from it is the way to the other side versus the phrase of time heals all. Time will dull it, but it doesn't create the learning from it. It's the intentionality that creates the learning that can make you better. It's a little like going to work out at the gym. If you're sore the next day, then you probably helped yourself and you're probably going to be stronger in a couple of days, right? But you got to go through the soreness part. And I think about it from a leadership perspective of, if you've never failed, you're not trying hard enough. A little bit of create the event, push yourself to the point of, maybe I went a little too far, but I know that I at least went far enough, and be intentional about getting to the other side of that. So I think there's a real leadership application to this notions of tensions of intentionality, yeah. But I think intentionality is the is the part that I makes me cock my ear and go, yeah, that.
Yeah, and I want to hear you, all three of you saying here is you have to do the work. You've got to really acknowledge the what happened and figure out how to get through the other side. And it's not easy. This is some of the hardest things we can all have is losing special people in our lives. And it's tough. So I think that really good insights on that. This next insight question for you, Ian, it was something I did not expect in the book, was this idea of smoothies as an analogy for loss in leadership. So this is definitely an Ian-ism because I was like, who's tying smoothies now to loss in leadership? I like smoothies. I didn't want to think about them when I go and think about like my dad who passed away when I go get a smoothie after a workout or something. But tell us more about this interesting metaphor.
Yeah, something crazy maybe that most people can relate to. You know, if you think about the smoothie industry, it's about a $12 billion global industry expected to grow to about $30 billion in revenue globally by the year 2032. So a lot of people have experience with smoothies. Here's the connection for me. Most smoothies are kind of a strange concoction and mix of ingredients, sometimes things that you wouldn't necessarily ordinarily think about putting together. So there's a lot of mixed flavors, textures that go along with the mixed emotions and feelings from loss. There's also a lot of smashing, crashing, bashing, slicing, dicing, and all the other things that you do to prepare. And then you throw it all in a blender, and then there's a lot of noise, and then there's a lot of silence. So you think about the rrr, you know, of the motor in the blender, and all of a sudden there's silence. And then you do it again, rrr, and the motor in the blender, and then there's silence. Well, a lot of people who've gone through loss will tell you exactly the same thing about what's going on in their head. Their head is banging all over the place, turning them upside down, the thought process of loss. Then all of a sudden, as you work your way through, maybe your family leaves after the funeral or whatever memorial may have taken place for the person. And there you are sitting by yourself in silence or sitting at night. Maybe it's trying to go to sleep and staring at the ceiling in the dark and in silence. And that silence can be deafening, just like the sound of the whirring motor of the blender. For me, the analogy really is all about recognizing these competing emotions and feelings and perspectives, just like you're dealing with the competing flavors and textures and all of the slicing, dicing, and chopping that you have to go through in putting together a smoothie. You come out the other end, you've created a product that most people would say tastes pretty good and is good for you, but the work that you have to put in to creating it, to your point earlier, JP, there's a lot of work. There's also a lot of work in processing a loss and coming out the other end with life and leadership lessons that make you a better human being. You're only going to find those lessons, frankly, if you look for them.
Well, I think it's a good lesson. It's a good analogy that we hadn't thought of before. And so maybe none of us will have smoothies the same way. We'll look at that differently.
That's why you put spinach in a smoothie, because you know it's good for you, even though it tastes weird.
Right. Or chia seeds.
My point exactly.
Reflecting on the book, what I appreciate is that each of the 35 authors, you have a reflection of the three things I learned about life and leadership from that special somebody. And I wonder if we can maybe just each of you just talk about maybe that one takeaway after reading the book, some of the key themes that stuck out to you or even resonated with that special someone that was that important life or leadership lesson.
I'll just start to kind of pick up on the general themes, and then maybe we can ask Lori and Bill to contribute from the connection to their essays. So as we've already agreed, lots of different stories, but there were some common threads. And probably the three most common threads that popped up repeatedly, you've already heard mention of some of them in our conversation so far, were courage, compassion, and curiosity. There are a lot of stories about needing the ability to fight through with fearlessness and determination to overcome obstacles and come out the other end better and stronger. There are a lot of examples on that's under courage, of course, and under compassion, a lot of discussion about assume positive intent, be empathetic and understanding and kind, as has come up a number of times already, be a great listener, be present for other people. One of the ones that really resonated with me was that there's a realization that people give and receive love in the best way they can, which is not always well understood. And then finally, on the curiosity side of things, it's kind of like do, be, try, achieve anything. Believe that you can achieve almost anything but it's always going to take a certain amount of passion and effort, energy, risk, some degree of falling down, failing, having to get back up and learn from that experience. Also to recognize that you want to live life to the fullest and a life of no regrets. Those were some of the things that really popped up under all those themes. Lori and Bill, I'm sure, have something to contribute to add to those based on their own personal essays that they wrote.
There was something around the need to share and to give voice to the experience. While it was hard to write the essay, I think I did have a need to share. I kind of got the feeling that some of the other essay authors had the need to share, to give voice, whether they knew it or not. Ian, I just want to thank you for the opportunity to allow us to share and give voice to our experience.
It was something I needed to do, and I didn't even know I needed to do it. I lost my grandmother in 1999. It's not like it was yesterday. But there's a reason I carry her photo around with me. I have it in my house. I have it in my office at work. I glance at it. There's this human element that sort of ties us all together. And I think that's why those themes do come out. I think about my own grandmother and all of the things that I say in there that I learned from her, but she was just a person who demonstrated grace. I think that could look different for different people, whatever your definition of that is. But it was an opportunity to really reflect on that. I didn't know all those years later I needed a good cry, but apparently I did. You'll be happy to know, Ian, everybody in my family that read it cried. So lots of crying. But it was an opportunity to reflect and honor somebody who was super important to me and share a little of what her life was to me. And hopefully that's helpful to somebody.
Well, get the tissue box out. I think it's great. Honestly, this is important because it's a lot of times we don't even recognize those feelings. And I think to put that on paper and make that tribute to that special someone is so powerful. And that's why people really should read this book. But Ian, I want you to leave with the one last thought here. And normally we ask the future of HR signature question. We're not going to ask that today, I think, out of respect for special someones in the topic. But Ian, if someone is listening right now and they're thinking about the special someone, maybe someone they've lost or someone who's still there, what would you want them to do with that feeling after our conversation today?
Write an essay. It turns out somewhat ironically that the book ends with the invitation for the reader to write an essay. That section was not even supposed to be in the book. I ended up deciding to include it because of all of the feedback I got from people like Lori and Bill and all the other contributing authors about what a cathartic experience and emotional release, if you will, people were feeling as a result of honoring their special somebody by writing about them. So anybody who's a reader, I would also encourage, write an essay about somebody special to you. Person may have passed away, but even if you're fortunate enough to be in a position in life where you haven't lost somebody very close to you, you could also write about someone who's still living with the focus on life and leadership lessons. And you may not choose to write a book, and you may not choose to even share it with many other people, but you might just write it for yourself, or you might write it for family, as Bill mentioned, and he shared with family members. The more important aspect is honor your special somebody and honor yourself.
Ian, wise words. Thank you so much, Ian, Bill, Lori. This has been a pleasure. Thank you for talking about lives lost and leadership found. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.